I'm going to get so sweaty in here.
Are you?
It is. Hot, hot,
hot, hot, hot. Okay. Is this the show? Are we in it?
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hi, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
It's getting sweaty.
It's not that it doesn't feel that bad to me. You know what
See,
it was?
You're used to it.
I had my big, fat gaming rig pumping out pixels and frames coming at me hot and heavy. Master Chief was there. Just so fucking, just pounding out the bad guys, and we were getting, it was getting hot and sweaty in here, so
Griffin
I apologize.
Griffin has a very sparse office that True. Has 700 pieces of electronic equipment in it.
So then one might actually argue it's not sparse at all. And in fact, it is filled with electronic equipment. Yeah, that's true. I imagine if I get the PC running, I imagine if I get the 3D printer running all at the same time, it's just going to, it could be a sweat lodge. Mm-hmm. I could go on a real journey in here. But I don't think it's that bad. And we're only in here for a little bit. So let's.
And I will also say that a lot of these electronics help you make a better podcast, which
sure.
is a timely thing.
Yeah.
Because we are talking about better podcasting through the Maximum Fun Drive.
Maybe I wouldn't say that the money that our listeners have so kindly sent us over the years allowed me to enhance the podcast by buying a 3D printer.
I'm not talking about the 3D printer.
No, but there is plenty of stuff within eyeshot of investments into the show.
Yeah, and these fancy microphones.
Sure. There's a power converter cleaner thing that I don't know what it does, but apparently it makes things sound better. There's all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. MaximumFun.org/join is the link you can go to if you want to support our show and the network at large. It is the Max Fun Drive going on right now. I think we have this week and next week, right? And then it's over. Time's running out. If you want to become a member of the network and you want the cool gifts that we have arranged for folks who give it whatever level feels comfortable for you, we'll go into those a little bit later on in the show. But yeah, please help us out. The turnout has been great, but we still need help, especially, you know, during these weird times where we are not touring and certain ways that we were making our living have become completely cut off from us. So once again, MaximumFun.org/join. You have a small wonder? I can go first if you'd like.
Please.
We've been watching Taskmaster, right? And we've talked about it like every week. We're just like really dog pounding through that show.
It yeah.
is a lot. And we are currently on the season with James Acaster on it, who I first became familiar with through The Worst Idea of All Time. He was a guest on there several times, and I thought he was hysterical.
Yeah.
And so I think it was last year, the year before last, we were on a trip looking for something to watch on TV, and he had a 4-part special on Netflix.
Have you not talked about this?
Called Repertoire. I may have brought it as a small wonder before, but we've started rewatching it again.
Yeah.
Because it's so fucking funny. He's so funny. God almighty, he's funny. It's really good stand-up. So that's what I'll bring.
I'm going to say wearing my glasses again.
You have been wearing bespectacled more than you usually are.
I had this lifestyle where I really only needed my glasses when I was in front of a computer.
Right.
And I was only really in front of a computer when I was working. So I got in this habit of not wearing glasses unless I went to work. And that lasted for several months into this pandemic. And then I just realized, you know why I wore glasses? Because they helped me see better and I liked the way they looked.
The traditional two reasons for wearing glasses.
I should, even though I'm not leaving the house, maybe I should wear them again.
Yeah.
So I just got a little reminder of like, hey, that was functional and not just related to leaving the house.
Cool. That doesn't make me worry about you at all.
One day I'll get to wearing pants that are not cozy, but I'm not there yet.
You wore jeans to like run out somewhere on one of our few excursions out of the house, and you were like, it was like watching a baby giraffe learn to walk again. There was something about the stiffness of the fabric that you were just not used to. I think the second you crossed the threshold back into our house,
I had to remove those.
You just ripped them off like you're a professional wrestler. Like, no way. I go first this week. I would like to talk to you about a subject that I don't know, you probably have some passing familiarity with, but you certainly do not, I believe, have a deep, deep admiration for Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
Oh.
Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, named after the professional skateboarder Tony Hawk. What's your exposure to Tony Hawk?
Trying to think. So as we've mentioned before on the show, I was not a Nintendo household.
Oh, no.
And I pretty much stopped playing video games once I entered high school, which was late 90s. So yes. My exposure to Tony Hawk actually didn't happen until college when my friends hit this like nostalgia tour of eBay that involved getting old games.
Right. Well, at that point, it wouldn't have been too super old because the first Tony Hawk came out in 1999.
Okay.
So you just barely missed the boat.
Yeah. This was like 2003 or so when I was like, oh, what is this Tony Hawk?
Okay. I mean, 2003 is still, I would argue, the prime of the Tony Hawk series. There were a ton of Tony Hawk games. The first one came out on PlayStation, Nintendo 64 and Dreamcast back in 1999, and it spawned this whole series that went on for a very, very, very long time until some more recent attempts to make Tony Hawk games have been terrible.
And skateboarding terminology into American households across the country.
Christ Air became a sort of household phrase. it was I realized after, what was the other one I did? I can't remember. It's like a cultural sort of phenomenon situation. Like it is NBA Jam is another sort of like great like example of this. Just like I feel like I didn't play video games like this, and then Tony Hawk's Pro Skater came out and it was like all I could think about, all I could play for a very, very long time, because me and my group of friends got extremely into Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, and it did like familiarize the world with skateboarding in a way that you know, indie skateboarding tapes or the X Games or whatever had never really had the crossover appeal to do.
Yeah, you just knew about the pants.
The
skateboarding pants, the big pants.
The what? The skateboarding pants?
The skateboarding kids, they wore the big pants.
I guess so.
And the Vans?
The Vans I'll give you. I don't know about big skateboard. Are you talking about JNCO jeans?
Yes.
I don't think those were, I don't think that was the dominion of skateboarders.
Like that was the skater look.
Okay. We could go back and forth about JNCO jeans. But yeah, so, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, 1999. You controlled one of any number of actual pro skaters. I'm trying to remember. I bet if I sat here for like 10 minutes, I could remember most. Bob Burnquist was one of them. Oh my God. Shamefully, I'm blanking. There's so many. And you play in a series of levels, and there are different goals in the career mode of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater that you had to accomplish, like, you know, achieve a certain score in 2 minutes or go find this hidden VHS tape, which is delicious. the most common one was collect all the letters in the word skate in order to accomplish that goal. And as the series went on, the career mode evolved and became like way more in depth with like a lot more stuff to do, all the way up to Tony Hawk's Underground, which was my personal favorite, where you actually created a skater. You could, I think, take a picture of your face with a digital camera. And at that point, you'd save it onto a floppy disk and then put that floppy disk in your computer and then like email it to this specific email address that the game would generate for you, assuming your PlayStation 2 could connect to the internet, and then you could rip it. It took forever, but then like, that's Griffin and he's wearing a beanie and he's really good at skateboarding, just like me. And you could like invest money in your board.
Do you think that's where you guys got the idea for Monster Factory? Do you think that was the
I mean, we did a Tony Hawk game on Monster Factory, so that's very full circle, if so. That, like, the career mode was, like, so dope. Like, we would go through and accomplish every goal, even when, like, the levels were super annoying. It would take us so much time to do it. That Tony Hawk's Underground game, by the way, was so great because it also had a map editor. And our friend Justin made Huntington, West Virginia, in the map editor in Tony Hawk's Underground. We probably spent maybe 300 hours total, like, playing in Huntington. Even, like, we knew, like, every single square inch of it and all the, like, in-joke references, like, that were in there from, like, the little NPCs who would give you the missions to do things. And we just spent so much time playing that game. But that reminds me of, like, the best thing, personally speaking, about Tony Hawk's Pro Skater was the multiplayer. It was so good. It was so good because it had the, like, things you'd expect, like, two people do skateboarding for 2 minutes and we see who can get the higher score. There was also graffiti mode, where every time you did a trick on, like, a ramp or something, you would change that ramp to your color, and whoever had the most objects at the end of time, that was their color, won. But you could also steal an opponent's object by doing a better trick on it. So there's, like, a lot of strategy to it that was really fun. The one we spent the most time playing was Horse, where it set you in front of like a ramp or a grinding rail or something like that and said you had 10 seconds to like do a trick, and who, you know, you set the score and then the other person had to beat it and then they could set the score, and then it just went back and forth and back and forth like that. I'm not like, I was thinking about this while I was prepping this segment, and like the sense memory of just like on a Saturday after like a sleepover, just playing horse in Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 or 2 or Underground or whatever, like for the entire day. Like that's just all we snacked on something in the Ito family and just played Tony Hawk horse just like nonstop.
Can I ask you with these tricks? This is what I never understood.
Yeah.
The tricks, was it like a memorization of which buttons in which order or were you just mashing?
Oh, no. I mean, maybe when you started out, you were just mashing, but, you know, they would add certain things to each title, but the core DNA of, like, what you did in Tony Hawk, like, never changed. The square button did flips. The circle buttons did grabs. Triangle was
grinds. See, I never learned that.
And, yeah. And
I was
so,
like, how are people doing these things? I had no idea.
Yeah. And so, you know, over time you would learn how to, you know, do a kickflip off a ramp. And then as you were landing, do like a manual so that you could link it to the next trick so you could grind. And by the end of it, like by the time we hit like Tony Hawk's Underground 2, me and my friends were just like bored gods where we would just like hit. I'm not kidding. We would play horse. But if you were still doing your trick after the 10 seconds ran out, you could do it. You could keep going until you finished your trick, either landed it or crashed. So we'd grind in a circular pool for like 8 minutes just going through and getting like a trillion points and then saying like, okay, your turn. It was so satisfying and so good, and it just introduced like a new kind of game into our like already pretty robust video game vocabulary. And I think that that's like really neat. Every time that I feel like I can pinpoint the exact times that that happened throughout like my history of playing games. And Tony Hawk Pro Skater was like such a huge like landmark thing. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the soundtrack. The soundtrack to the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater games was a collection of mostly punk and ska music.
Yes.
That is so delectable, so memorable.
That you didn't have more of an affection for ska based on the music in Tony Hawk.
Well, that was the only ska I really enjoyed, I would say. Yeah, I never really went through a ska phase. Despite how many like sort of checkerboard items of clothing I would say that I owned at various times. But God, it was iconic. Like it was like these songs were, I also didn't go through a punk phase, mm-hmm. but I did go through a Tony Hawk Pro Skater phase where I would listen to a lot of these songs.
Probably because you were never much of a rude boy.
I would, which
is a ska joke.
I know, I got it. I don't think I even need to play any of the songs here on the show because I think I can just sort of psychically inject it into mm-hmm. the minds of everybody.
Oh,
So I can just say like Superman by Goldfinger. And it's just like,
you're there.
It's just, you're there. You're there with me. They did a remake of Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 and 2 a few years ago. That wasn't very good, but they're just doing it again this year, I think. Just another remake of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2. So maybe this one will be good. But
can you still play as Tony Hawk and is he old?
I think so. I think you can probably play as like his kid. I think his kid's also a skateboarder at this point. Tony Hawk is also like pretty solid. I did an interview with him once when I was still writing about video games, and it was like a weird thing because like I have no knowledge about the guy himself aside from like what buttons I can press to make him do kickflips. But he was he is very funny and very self-deprecating.
Yeah,
there's like a long list of times that he has cited of people like not knowing who he is despite the fact that he is like kind of a household name.
Yeah.
It's delightful. What is your first thing?
My first thing is caves.
Oh, yeah, caves. Very afraid of them, but cool things, these caves.
Much like Texas is the Lone Star State and West Virginia is the Mountain State, Missouri, cave state.
You're kidding me.
Mm-mm.
Didn't know it was so porous.
Over 6,000 caves in this state.
Holy shit, that's a lot of caves.
Mm-hmm. I've always really liked caves.
Yeah, caves are great. The best thing about caves is the verb for exploring them is one of the best words I would say in the entire English language.
Did you know actually the formation and development of caves is known as spelogenesis?
Spelogenesis.
Which is, I guess, where spelunking comes from.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do a lot of spelunking growing up?
No. Okay. We just walked through paved arm rail caves.
Oh, no, I would count that as spelunking.
Oh, really? I thought spelunking was like you're rappelling. You've got gear and you're got a little headlamp.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I went into a cave. I wouldn't call that cave hiking. There's a word for it.
The way you describe your cave experience seemed very rogue. It seemed very like like DIY cave exploring?
I had a couple times of DIY cave exploring, mostly at our youth pastor's farmhouse.
Yeah.
Had caves like in the back that we would just like just dip into with flashlights until we got very afraid, which didn't take very long. But there was also Carter Caves, which I want to say was in Kentucky somewhere, that was like you are describing, like guided paths through like really genuinely gorgeous, gorgeous caverns.
Most caves are solutional caves, or also called karst caves, which is when the rock is soluble. So like limestone,
right,
chalk, marble, you know, when it can be worn down by water.
Right. How could any other cave be formed?
Well, there's like volcanic caves too.
Oh, I guess so. Where there was like a volcanic channel of lava that like over time went on. Huh, interesting.
Yeah. Caves in general, though, can't be more than 9,800 feet vertical below the surface, just with the pressure of rock. If it's like deeper than that, it would like collapse in on itself.
Yeah. Oh, and here it comes. Now my like claustrophobia is kicking in.
Yeah, it's difficult to tell how old a cave is, but there are what they call isotopic dating techniques where you can look at the cave sediments to see kind of like rings on a tree, like you look and examine the the cave dirt.
I imagine the results are just always like old as fuck.
Old
this cave is so old you would not nobody's ever like, oh shit, this cave is 2 months old. Huh. Wild.
I wanted to talk about my particular cave close to my heart.
Oh, yeah?
Which is Merrimack Caverns in Missouri.
I've heard of this.
Yeah, there are billboards freaking everywhere around Missouri, which is probably why you're familiar with it. If you've driven anywhere in Missouri or surrounding states, you have seen a billboard for this cave.
What's so great about this cave?
Well, it's existed for the past 400 million years.
Okay.
Which is pretty big. There's also a lot of lore surrounding it, which I will get to, but I will say it is 4.6 miles of cave underground.
Wow.
Which is a lot of cave. There's a lot of caves in Missouri worth mentioning, but Merrimack is kind of the showpiece. Part of it is because there is a structure in it that they call the Wine Table, which is the world's rarest cave formation. It is an onyx table that stands 6 feet high and is supported on three natural legs.
Wow. Impressive.
It's a fancy cave.
Yeah.
The story of the cave is kind of fun. It's got a real circus quality to it. The big story, and they'll tell you this when you do a tour of the cave, is it was supposedly a hideout for Jesse James.
I feel like every cave has a... Yeah.
Back in the 1870s, the legend is that a sheriff tracked James and his brother to the cave, waiting for him to emerge, but then he found another exit throughout the cave and escaped.
Wow.
But I think who really kind of made it famous is Lester B. Dill, who was the big showman for the cave. He invented the bumper sticker as a means of promoting the caves.
He was the first one to do bumper sticker? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, all these fucking billboards make sense.
He, in the 1930s, started traveling the country offering to paint farmers' barns for free as long as he could paint Merrimack Caverns on the roof. At one point, 400 barn billboards existed in 40 states, and 75 still remain today.
So this is more a segment about, like, the inventor of mass advertising.
They also, this is what is hilarious, in 1960, they rented billboard space in the cave.
Seems excessive.
And they claimed it was the only underground billboard in the world.
Okay. So then they had billboards other places, like, come see the only underground billboard in the world.
They also, like in Missouri, they advertise it as like Jesse James's hideout.
Yeah.
Merrimack Caverns.
Ooh, wow.
It's kind of charming. It's funny, like when family and relatives would come to visit, we would take them to Onondaga, which was like a classier kind of cave experience. Like more national park, you know, like America's, you know, wilderness kind of feel. Merrimack Caverns is like Branson.
It's where they get funnel cakes in the cave. There's just natural funnel cake formations growing inside.
They have several rooms of the cave that they have named based around like the theme behind that room. I mentioned the wine room where the wine table is located, that, you know, rarest cave formation. Sure. They also have a greatest show under earth room where they do a light show.
I doubt that, unless they've been doing some serious updates to this light show, I doubt it still holds that title.
And then there's the Hollywood room. So there was a movie called Tom Sawyer in 1973 that starred Jodie Foster as Becky Thatcher, and they get lost in a cave, and that is filmed in Merrimack Caverns. Also, an episode of Lassie was filmed in that part of the cave. They still talk about that on the tour
today.
That's
sad and great and perfect.
And just to give you like some Missouri folksiness, like the tour guides will kind of take you through these rooms and they'll kind of tell you things. And I mentioned the wine room on the tour. They will tell this joke that, you know, it was called the wine room for the wine table, but it is now called the wine room because of the whining that visitors do when they learn the room is only accessible after climbing 58 stairs. Doesn't that just put you on the tour? Don't you feel like you're
really
on the tour right now?
I really just went on a fucking, like, my own personal mental jungle cruise sort of situation.
My biggest thing that I remember, and my parents always found it kind of funny, like, it's paved. You walk in, there's a gift shop in the cave.
Perfect.
And at some point, they sing the Star Spangled Banner, and they have a flag wave at some point in the tour. I want to say it's the end of the tour. I don't know if they still do this. But just to really bring home the kind of, like, patriotism and splendor of this
whole,
they, like, full on, like, play and have a flag wave.
This hole loves America. America loves this hole. I'm like, traveling back to, like, I was remembering while you were talking about a trip we took to Ruby Falls in Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. And I like have all these memories of like doing a rock tumbler thing and like, there's something with like, we did actual panning for gold and like all these things around Ruby Falls, which is like this sort of touristy underground waterfall situation. But now I'm also having this like Mandela effect situation where I can't remember if that's a trip I actually went on or not, or if that's just like a thing I remember like my brother's doing on some, like I know I needed to ask them about this.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice waterfall. I don't remember.
We used to go to this cave like every year, partially because it's a great summertime activity because it's like 60 degrees.
It's so nice.
And also, it's just, I don't know, there's something really cool, like the stalactites, stalagmites, the whole thing of caves, the water in there, these just like incredible drips and structures and bats. And
the acoustic like reality of being in a cave is like the most incredible thing about it for me. Like, when we used to do sort of unauthorized spelunking in our, farmland caves, it's like those, I'm really fascinated by like anti-noise chambers that like are scientifically like completely devoid of sound, and so you go inside and soon like the sound of your own heartbeat is so loud that you like can't. I feel like caves kind of have that going on in a way that I find very like
I thought the love of caves was so deep that I could take a geology class in college and it would be successful for me. That was not the case.
No,
turns out there are more than just a few types of rocks.
Ugh, basalt.
Ugh. And I couldn't hang.
No one's got time for you, basalt. I don't know. Is basalt related to salt? Is it?
I don't even know the word you're saying. I'm sorry.
Oh, I may be saying it wrong. Is the other problem? Mm-hmm. So just a couple primo, just
just real rockheads over here.
Yeah. Hey, can I steal you away?
Yes.
Well, looks like we got a couple grumpons, and I would love to read this first one, if you don't mind.
Please.
I haven't looked at it. So it's from Tess. 4Nate says, congratulations to my wonderful boyfriend, Nate, for finishing his master's in electrical and computer engineering. I'm so proud of you for all the hard work you put in, especially when you had to take classes at home. Wherever you end up working, I know you will do great. I love you so much. My top scientist. Don't forget to drink water. I don't know if that was for... don't know if that was for Nate or for us or for just the audience. But I do appreciate that Tess added in, do you have particular pronunciations you need to clarify, which is the service we offer all of our Jumbotron writers. Scientist isn't a typo. It's just scientist with a sh sound at the start.
Yeah. Do not correct it. This is an important part of the message.
Fantastic. No, that was mostly me saying that so people didn't think I made a goof up.
No. I appreciated that she gave us that guidance so we didn't somehow gloss over it on
sure,
accident.
Sure, of course.
Can I read the next one?
Yes.
This message is for Daniel. It is from Nicole. Dear Daniel, I entered to win this Jumbotron on July 3rd. Then that evening you proposed to me.
Ooh.
I need more than 350 characters to express all the reasons you are wonderful. But to sum it up, thank you for being my best friend and for blessing my life. I love every inch of you and then some. P.S. Thanks, Mike, for introducing us both to the McElroys. Ooh, a two message in one.
Got
there.
And then we frown on that. The secret, the deception.
This is for Daniel. Mike, get out of here.
Get the hell out of here, Mike. We're not going to tell you again. You pay for your own freaking message. One sweet missive at a time, folks, or else they all get mixed up in our heads.
Can I hear your second thing?
Yes, my second thing I think you will find much more relatable than Mr. Hawk and his aerial sort of journey. I want to talk about, wow, I am really, you could carbon date this episode based on the topics we've selected so far. I am going to talk about Rilo Kiley because I've been getting like nonstop like Facebook ads or whatever. I think back in, I want to say like 2004, I like did for the first and only time like likes on Facebook. It's like, what are the movies you like? It's like, well, Lost in Translation. That's like where I was at. And now to this day, it's like, happy 50th birthday, Lost in Translation. It's like, I need to get rid of all of this because it is not what I use Facebook. But Rilo Kiley is one of those things, and they are re-releasing their first self-titled LP, which is like incredibly rare. I've never heard it before. And as far as I can tell, it's like not on the internet anywhere. So it just reminded me how much I really like Rilo Kiley. Particularly two albums, there was Execution of All Things and More Adventurous, which I think came out in 2000 and 2004. And I just, wow. Listening to those albums while preparing this segment was, again, just a really, really great little time capsule. But it also led to like kind of a realization about myself and my music taste that I found very interesting. If you've never heard Rilo Kiley, first of all, it's a fucking lie because they've had their songs in everything. I have an extensive list of TV shows that their music appeared in. But they were an early aughts rock band. They were on Barsook Records, which was an indie record label in Seattle that had it's probably pound for pound my favorite like collection of musicians to ever exist. Barsook had Death Cab, Harvey Danger, They Might Be Giants, Rilo Kiley, Maps and Atlases, Fantagram was on there, and The Long Winters were also on Barsook Records. And I think like a lot of like Seattle rock bands, Rilo Kiley was very guitar forward and very just sort of like, you know, loud and melodic. It was led by Jenny Lewis, who has gone on to have an incredibly like successful career since then. We saw her in concert at Austin City Limits.
We did,
which
yeah.
was very fun. But I first sort of like became aware of her music through Rilo Kiley, like I think most folks did. I actually started listening to Rilo Kiley because somebody told me that Jenny Lewis was in The Wizard. She played like the I can't remember her name.
The girl.
I guess the one girl that goes across the country playing video games. I want to just, I guess, start by playing one of their biggest songs, which is off the album More Adventurous, called Portions for Foxes. That song is named after a very like obscure Bible verse. It's also like one of the catchier songs I've ever heard about like a really unhealthy physical relationship. And I like, there's something about that juxtaposition of it being a very fun, very poppy, very memorable, catchy song about like kind of a toxic situation between people that feels very Rilo Kiley and feels very like of the music from that era. There's just something really clean about that song. Like, Ginny Lewis's voice is like incredible, and she can like alternate between these very kind of vulnerable verses to just like wailing through the choruses. But I also feel like the guitars of this band are so incredible. Everybody played guitar, not at the same time, but like everybody was a multi-instrumentalist. And so that's why it's very guitar forward. And I feel like I could do all the guitar parts from this song like with my mouth right now. And that I think is like indicative of the Seattle like rock music that was coming out around that genre. And thinking about it, like listening to this band and listening to the music again this morning, and then also looking back over the history of bands that I've talked about on this show, it was always a subject that I was interested in, this idea of when I am older, I'm talking about like when I was in my teens or whatever, looking forward, like when I'm older, what is going to be like the crystallized era of music, or the crystallized like canon of music that is like the like music that I identify with, or the one that I like really think established my like core musical likes and dislikes, right? And looking back, like my mom and dad were like into Chicago and Sly and the Family Stone and Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And like these bands. And whenever we went on a trip or something, I remember we stayed with our friends, the Stutlers, once, and they had a record player, and they spent the whole weekend playing records, and it was like the same, you know, four or five bands.
Yeah.
And but they all knew every word, and I became like really interested in like, okay, so this is your guys' music. Like this is the And, you know, there was that for people who grew up in the 90s who are like, came up through grunge. And it's just like, that was my, and looking back, I think like that 2002 to 2005 era is where all of my musical tastes really crystallized. Yeah. And I think listening to Rilo Kiley, it's like, that was kind of the sound it crystallized around.
Yeah. I made a mistake, I think, while I was in college. I mean, it wasn't a mistake, but I became friends with a group of people who exposed me to a lot of music, but they exposed me to a lot of music that had already happened.
Yeah.
And so my window in college, I missed a lot of those like new artists. I mean, I would hear some of them on the college radio station, but mostly I was hanging out in a group of people who were like, "Hey, have you heard much Stone Temple Pilots?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure, let's go back." Let's go back to then. And I kind of missed the music of the period. It was only like several years later that I heard Rilo Kiley.
I very much lucked out because I was in that camp all through high school. The only bands I listened to were like They Might Be Giants and Ben Folds.
Yeah.
And then in like my freshman year of college, I hung out with like mostly like hipsters who, some of which are very dear friends, some of which turned out to be very unsavorably individuals. But their impact on like my musical taste is like very clear, because they sort of broke me out of that echo chamber and showed me a bunch of music, some of which I found completely intolerable, but some of which, like Rilo Kiley and Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, and Wolf Parade, and like all of these bands and TV on the Radio is one of those, like all of that stuff really came about in I guess it was college, right? I guess it was around that time, and that is it is strange for me to reflect on, like that's when I found the music that I'm going to like for the rest of my life. And I just think Rilo Kiley is like it falls perfectly. It is the median of that, like, that interest. Okay. So the songs that Rilo Kiley had, music in, the shows rather that they had songs in, Dawson's Creek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 6 Feet Under, Gilmore Girls, The OC, Grey's Anatomy, One Tree Hill, Dollhouse, 90210, and Wedding Crashers. They had a song on the soundtrack for Wedding Crashers.
Wow.
So just like all of it.
That is a very specific time period.
It is crystallized around the crystal. It's like,
a 4-year window.
Yes, it is a perfect 4-year window that is like, I don't know, just where a lot of my musical interests lie. Rilo Kiley, great band. They broke up in I think like 2011, 2012, and have sort of flirted with, you know, doing a tour here or putting out like an EP here. But yeah, these two albums specifically, if you've never listened to them, check out More Adventurous and Execution of All Things, which came out in 2002. And to leave us off, I want to play Spectacular Views off that album. Indifferent, but distance perfectly, projected endlessly. It's so fucking beautiful. There are no rules for the coast today. I just felt very much like NPR. Let's listen to Spectacular Views off 2002's The Execution of All Things. What's your second thing?
Before I do my second thing, should we say something else about Max Fun Drive?
I think we absolutely should say something else about Max Fun Drive.
Can we talk about the levels, maybe?
Yes, let's talk about the levels. So, whatever level you are comfortable giving at, we fully recognize that it is a weird and bad time. But whatever support you are able to give, we very, very much appreciate. And if you give at $5 a month, you are going to get access to all of the bonus content, over 200 hours of bonus content.
Yeah.
For all the shows.
Bonus content keeps dropping. I just listened to Lords of Crunch the other day.
Lords of Crunch,
and
yes.
It is a delight.
That is the Adventure Zone live show that Justin DM'd using a serial-based game that he created himself. It is a...
A plus.
It is a wild, wild journey, that one. There is so much bonus content, and if you enjoy our shows and you have not listened to it, you are missing out on a lot of stuff. And that's at $5 a month, $10 a month. You get access to an enamel pin designed after the show of your choice by Megan Lynn Cott. They are beautiful, beautiful pins.
Yeah, so when you donate, you can select all the shows that you listen to receive part of your donation. You can also select whatever pin you want.
Yes.
So, you know, obviously we're going to push our wonderful pin, but there are a lot of great pins out there.
Great pins, great
for
shows.
For you to choose from.
Yeah, that's the great thing about when you join the network. You do choose exactly. Max Fun takes a portion of the of what you give to, you know, keep the lights on and support us in the ways that they support us. But then you elect to give like specifically to the shows that you listen to.
It's a very... And so we'd encourage folks who are going to continue their donation to still log in and maybe update with the new shows you're listening to.
Yeah, of course. We also just started doing boosting this year. So like if you don't want to jump from the $10 donation level where you get the pin and a membership card and the bonus content, but you don't want to jump up to $20, you know, you can do 12, you can do 13,
yeah,
you can do whatever. If that reflects like how much you've been listening to our shows, then that's awesome. $20 a month, you get the card, you're gonna get the pin, you're gonna get the bonus content, you also get a Max Fun game pack that has a bunch of really cool shit in it, like dice
and cards and
other
cool
neat stuff. There's other levels that you can give at, which you can see again at MaximumFun.org/join. But yeah, if you're thinking about doing it, you know, there's not much time left in the drive, so we would encourage you to just go do it now. Doesn't take very long. And we really, really, really appreciate you.
You don't want to know what my voice sounds like without this beautiful microphone.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And we need those donations here, to actually, get these beautiful microphones.
Let me plug in the old microphone real quick so you can hear what Rachel's old voice sounds like.
Click. Griffin.
Why would I'm different?
It's time for me to do my second thing.
But why would a different... Are you going to do the whole second thing in that voice, or should I switch the mic back?
No.
All right, let me plug this other mic in. Crash! Oh, I dropped it on the floor and it broke. So now you do have to do the whole second segment like that. Oh, no. And if we're going to buy a new good microphone, we need folks to go to MaximumFun.org/join. Here, you can use my microphone and I'll use the bad one. Okay, babe, go on right ahead.
My second thing is Nick Nickelodeon.
All right.
Can we share this microphone so you stop sounding like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Are we talking about the whole freaking channel?
Yes.
Okay.
And you have talked about Are You Afraid of the Dark? We have addressed SNCC.
Well, okay, SNCC's gotten its time in the spotlight.
We have not talked about the network as a whole.
God, I'll be honest, babe, that feels ambitious. That feels like a lot to cover in one segment.
Well, I'm not doing a whole book here.
Okay. There probably is. I would read the hell out of a book about
Yeah, I would too.
Okay.
Nickelodeon was the first network devoted entirely to kids programming.
Really? Wow.
I know, you'd think PBS, right? But PBS had adult programming.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Too.
No, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was conceptualized by Dr. Vivian Horner, who worked for the Bank Street College of Education and launched in Columbus, Ohio.
Huh. There's a lot about Nickelodeon. I would have thought for sure it launched at Universal Studios.
It officially launched on April 1st, 1979.
Whoa, holy shit. What?
Yeah.
It didn't launch in like 1991?
No. I mean, that's when we're familiar with it, but it was around
before
then.
What was on Nick before we were watching it?
So Nickelodeon started with a show called Pinwheel.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which was similar to Sesame Street. There were action scenes in a Victoria-style boarding house with Muppets.
Okay.
Or puppets would be more appropriate.
Sure, yeah. Muppets are, the Jim Henson Estate is very litigious.
When Pinwheel was phased out, it was replaced by Eureka's Castle.
I was going to say, now I remember Eureka's Castle.
Yeah, that's
Castle.
What probably you're thinking
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I loved Nickelodeon. Like, as a kid, like to have a network that I could just turn on and anything was for me.
Yeah,
that was ideal.
Literally anything that came on I can't think of another TV network that was ever like that. And I think, Nick, I aged out of it at some point, but there was a channel that you could just turn it on and it would have
that was like
something.
When we got cable, that was like my number one destination.
Absolutely.
It, as I mentioned, just started with the one show. And when they started to build out their programming, it was still only from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. And then it would switch to the movie channel.
I guess, yeah, that makes sense.
That makes sense, right?
Sure.
The hallmark that kind of started it and kind of gave the origin to the green slime that is associated with Nickelodeon is the Canadian sketch comedy You Can't Do That on Television.
That was, okay,
1981 is when that started.
On Nick.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that was its American debut, was on Nickelodeon.
Okay, interesting. Fine. Yeah, yeah. I think that probably established the grand tradition of Canadian television shows joining the Nick network, because most live action shows that were on Nick were Canadian in origin.
The Green Slime also, as you'll recall, showed up in Double Dare.
Double Dare showed up in Figure It Out.
And the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, which started in 1988.
I guess there was lots of slime being flung around. I imagine Mr. Jim Carrey ingested an unconscionable amount of slime during his many appearances on that award show.
So Nickelodeon started with no advertising. Much like PBS, it was just children's programming. When it wasn't children's programming, like the interstitial... was actually a person dressed as a mime.
Okay.
When it was commercial-free service, it was a male mime portrayed a character doing tricks in front of a black background in between programs.
How did they get money to make the network?
So that was the problem.
I could have freaking told you that, Nickelodeon.
By 1984, they were operating at a loss of $10
million. Yeah.
They did a rebranding that year, and within 6 months, it became the dominant channel in children's programming. They rebranded themselves as the first kids network, because that was when Disney Channel and Cartoon Network were coming up.
Okay.
And that's when they started doing traditional advertising as well. I mean, if you think about it, the origins, as I mentioned, was... you know, with a woman who focused on education, you know, and so she's focusing very much in the Sesame Street vein of
like,
what is going to be beneficial to kids' education. As they operated at a loss, it became what is going to keep us in business.
Right, yeah.
In 1985, also to keep kind of viewership high is when they launched Nick at Night. So that was you got like the Donna Reed Show, Bewitched, all those kind of older shows so that adults would keep watching it.
Yeah,
in the nighttime.
That was when we would just turn it off.
Yeah.
Because the shows were boring as hell.
As soon as it went black and white, it was like, oh, this isn't for me.
Good night. Bye.
1990, Nickelodeon Studios came about.
Okay.
Which was always like the big prize for Double Dare, was that you could go to Nickelodeon
Studios. Did you ever go?
No. Did you?
Yeah. I mean, it was at Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida. Mm-hmm. So if you went to Universal, you could do it. And I remember we went and they were filming the Mystery Files of Shelby Woo. And it was like the fucking coolest shit ever.
That's cool.
I got some special limited edition GAC. I got special secret GAC that I took home to all my friends. I was like, guys, look, it's thermodynamic. So it's purple and you slap your hand into it and it turns white.
Oh, wow.
I think they eventually released that on the market, but I was first on my block with hot GAC. All my friends are like, is that Hot Gak? I was like, yeah, I played with it while I watched the Mystery Files of Shelby Woo in person.
Nickelodeon Studios closed in 2005 and was converted into the Blue Man Group Theater in 2007.
A shame. A heartbreaker.
This is also around the time they did Nickelodeon Magazine, which I had forgotten about, but was the result of a multi-million dollar joint marketing agreement with Pizza Hut.
Okay.
And so Nickelodeon Magazine was available for free at Pizza Hut.
I don't remember that. Damn, I wish I had that hot tip. I loved that magazine.
The reason you think Nickelodeon came about in the early 90s is because that's when they started with Doug and Rugrats and Ren and Stimpy.
Right.
And Rocko's Modern Life.
Yeah. The Four Horsemen.
And then a year later was SNCC. So that was Are You Afraid of the Dark? Clarissa Explains It All That, The Amanda Show, Kenan and Kel.
Boy,
which launched the careers of Kenan Thompson, Amanda Bynes, and Jamie Lynn Spears.
And Kel Mitchell in a different direction, but sure.
Nickelodeon released its first feature-length film in 1996 with Harriet the Spy.
Oh, God, yes.
Mm-hmm. Went on to earn twice its $13 million budget. And then 2 years later, the Rugrats movie, which grossed more than $100 million.
Shoot, jeez.
Became the first non-Disney animated movie to surpass that amount.
Are you going to talk about Nick News with Linda Ellerbe?
I am not going to talk
Let's
about Nick News.
Let's just save that because that's a whole segment in and of itself.
Yeah,
Nick
we
News
should
with Linda Ellerbe
that.
Is the fucking coolest shit that Nick ever did. All right, we'll circle back to Linda.
I was just going to end with 1999, where the channel previewed SpongeBob SquarePants directly after the Kids' Choice Awards, became the most popular Nicktoon in the channel's history. Consistently ranking as the highest rated series for Nickelodeon since 2000. By 2001, a third of the series audience was made up of adults.
Wow. I think I missed that by a hair's
yeah,
width.
Yeah, SpongeBob was after my time for
But now
sure.
Henry's been watching it and it's great because it's like fucking funny. Like one of very few shows that Henry watches that I watch. I'm like, that's fucking, hey, this SpongeBob guy's funny. Hey, thank you for making me. This is a deeply nostalgic episode.
Yeah, it was.
Thank you. I mean, we even talked about caves, which is just old holes. Thank you to Bowen and Augustus for the use of our theme song, Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. And one last time, MaximumFun.org/join. Please think about supporting us and the other shows that you listen to on the network. And look at all the different pledge levels. And yeah, we thank you all very much. There's been lots of folks who have turned out already. And if you haven't and you like our shows and you rely on them for entertainment or, you know, whatever, think about helping us out.
Yeah. And if you're not able to at this time, feel free to just tweet about the hashtag MaxFundDrive to let your friends know in case they're able to give right now.
I think that's it. Let's stop recording and go about our days. I'm gonna eat a hot dog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what are you gonna do?
I'm gonna listen to you complain about eating a Hot Pocket later.
I said a hot dog, but I do love that the way you connect me, but like me that lives in your brain. I could say like I'm going to go eat a steak, and you'll be like, oh, a Hot Pocket, huh? That's cool.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.